This is the Pitch Vision Academy show number 84. This is the Pitch Vision Academy cricket show. You can find us at pitchvision.com and email us on mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sampath in Australia. Coming up on the show, we get the lowdown of David's game on the weekend. And as usual, we answer your questions for this week. David, just as we were talking before, you said that you've had really good weather up there in the UK. So I'm guessing another great game for you guys?
Yes, yeah, we've been very lucky. We've seen some really good weather. As you know, Kevin, the last two summers over here haven't been the best. But this year, so far anyway, you've always got to touch wood when you say things like that. But this year, so far, we've had a really good summer. And again, we had a beautiful day and got a full game in that went the entire 100 overs. And good news for me, because I managed to win a toss at last.
Ah, it's good signs, David. Good signs ahead.
Exactly. So, you know, a beautiful sunny day, not a cloud in the sky. We had to bat. Started quite poorly, lost a couple of wickets early on. But our middle order rallied. Our two middle order players who both got first team experience. One is a regular first team player who had been dropped because for tactical reasons, they wanted a bit more of a solid opening batsman instead of this chap who's a bit more a bit more of an aggressive batsman. But you know, he's a good quality player, so he went in at number three, and the number four came in as well, and they both hit 40s, solid 40s, which put us in a good position.
Yeah, nice.
And I thought we were going to struggle a bit because we didn't have a great deal of top order batsmen. We had quite a few of those players who can bat anywhere between sort of 6 and 10. You know, those sort of players. You know, they just sit in the middle order and they can bat anywhere. We had a few of those. You know, 6 is probably a little bit high, 10 is probably a little bit low, those sort of batsmen. And they managed to put on some good scores. They hung around a bit. And everything was looking good when we play 100 over games with a maximum of 50 overs per innings, but you can declare before that if you want to. As our number seven went in, I told him I wanted 200. That was when the score was 182. And that was in the 42nd over. We reached the 200 mark in the 46th over.
Oh, nice.
But I thought, well, we've still got 4 overs left. We're going well. I'll just give it another over or two just to see what happened. And the number three batsman, who was the first team player, said to me, don't declare. There's no point in declaring. We'll bowl them out in 50 overs easily.
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, well, I'll see what happens, see how many we hit. And in the last 4 overs, we went from 208 to 260.
Wow. So it was your number three that really gave it the long handle, did he, David?
No, he was out. He was out for 43, and he was sat with me, and I said, I think I'm going to declare, and he said, no.
He was the one giving you advice.
He said, no, don't bother declaring, because I was thinking to myself, 200, 220, that's plenty. That's plenty, you know. Well, we got to 220 in 47 overs. I could have declared at the end of the 47th over when we had 219 we had. So we had 50 overs to bowl them out. They were never really going to go for it. 260 is a massive score. Certainly our level anyway, you know, anything over 200 is a big score. And we were, you know, they were staring down the barrel of 260.
Yeah.
So we got an early wicket and everything was looking good. We had two spinners in the side. So, and remember, it's a beautiful day and the wicket was a little bit dusty. So we were looking forward to bowling them out. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be. We managed to get through 50 overs and get them to 9 down.
Yep.
For 189, but we couldn't get that last wicket. That means that was a draw.
Sounds like a repeat of the first Ashes test, David. But in hindsight, though, I think that declaration would have been worthwhile, because 200 or 220, the other team would have thought they're in with the chance and they would have actually had a go and, you guys would have had to tense to get them out as well. But as you said, when you got 260, immediately they would have come out with a defensive mindset thinking, we just got to last this out for a draw here. So did you guys discuss the game after as a team, thinking, should you have declared or not? Or did you just take it on the chin and say bad luck?
Well, not really. I mean, it was my mistake. You know, I shouldn't have listened. Was, you know, it was a bit of a rookie captain's mistake. And I listened to the advice of some of a batsman, you know, and batsmen always say bat for longer, don't they? Of course they do. That's what batsmen do. So, you know, I should have followed my thinking and thought to myself, you know, 220 after 47 overs, and that would have given them three extra overs. It would have given us three extra overs to bowl them out. And, you know, I think that would have been a pretty close finish then. And I think, we would have won. You know, I think we would have won. And I think we probably would have won if I'd have declared at the end of the 48th as well, when we were on 235. So, I mean, you know, it just goes to show that sometimes you can be in the heat of battle, you can go away from your principles. And you know what my thinking is when it comes to declarations: declare early, be aggressive, go out and bowl them out. And that's exactly what I didn't do. So I won't be making that mistake again. I'll be putting in the declaration nice and early and saying to them, go and get it. And if you know, if a team gets 220 batting second to win a game, you just got to take your hat off to them and say, well batted, because that's a good
that's a good
score to get at this level, at the level that we play.
Yeah.
But the good news is that because of the way that our point system works in our league, if you draw a game, then they take into account how close the game was. So you have, you get 10 points for a draw, but that's split between the two teams. So if if it's a very close finish, you get 5 each. And, you know, if it's not so close a finish, it gradually goes more towards the team who've batted first, until if you're more than 40 runs ahead at the end, then you get all 10 points and the opposition get no points.
Oh, wow.
So, but it's 18 points for a win. So there's the difference there. So in this case, we got all 10 points because we were, what, 70 runs ahead of them at the end. You know, they were nowhere near it. So we got all 10 points. They didn't get any. So we moved up a place in the league. So we're up to third now.
That's actually a pretty good system. I think we should get that up here as well. David, I think we have a couple of questions from our readers, so we should put our thinking caps on and get ready. Welcome to the question section for this week. David, our first question is from Lex, and he asks, it would be good if you could tell me a little more about the signs of overtraining. Now, David, can you really overtrain, or is there such a thing as overtraining in the wrong way, which can lead to injuries, or can you really actually overtrain that could harm you?
Yes, you can. It's not one of those things that you see very often, especially in club cricket, where it's usually the other problem. It's usually undertraining, if anything.
Yeah.
But it can be done. I mean, you do get people who get a real dedication towards improving. You know, if you feel you've got a bit of talent and you really want to make the step forward, then, you know, maybe you're hitting the gym every day and you're training and you're playing lots of games because you've got a bit of talent, and you may be playing three or four in the summer, three or four games a week, maybe even five games a week sometimes. It can get to a point where you're just doing too much. And there's no hard and fast rule about what overtraining really is, but there are things you can see that maybe signs of it. But there's no, you know, you can't say if this happening then you're definitely overtraining. You have to kind of work it out for yourself. So things like, if you're feeling tired all the time but you can't sleep, that's a classic of overtraining. If you're constantly a bit run down, you know, you've got a cold all the time, you know, you've got a cough, you're a bit fluid, whatever, you know, little signs of, you know, muscle aches and things like that. I'm not talking about the soreness you get after you've been training or been playing. I'm talking about you've just got aches and pains all the time, and your joints never seem to feel right, and it never feels right. You're never getting any recovery time in.
Yeah.
And you're finding that your results aren't going the way that you would want them to go. So, for example, if you're training in the gym, instead of your weights going up, you'll suddenly finding that, if anything, you're having to cut back on the weight that you're doing, because suddenly you don't feel as strong as you were, or you can't run as far as you were before.
Yeah,
there's lots of things that can cause that. Overtraining is one of them. But with all that said, it's a lot harder to overtrain than some people think. If you're going to the gym three times a week, training once a week with your team and playing on the weekends, that's probably not going to get you overtraining, unless you suddenly, you go from nothing to doing that all in 1 week, then, maybe then. But generally speaking, you're that's not going to cause you a major problem for most people. But if you're training every day, if you're doing something every day and you're never giving your body time to recover, then after a while, it's going to start feeling the effects. Because a general principle of training is that it's called supercompensation. And if you've done sort of any kind of study of, PE or physical recreational training or anything like that, you'll know about supercompensation. It's when it's when you train, for a short amount of time, you become less fit, less good at that particular thing. So if you're doing weight training, for example, you're doing bicep curls, the evil bicep curls, then then for a short time after you've trained, your muscles are weaker, your bicep muscles are weaker, and then after a little while, after a few hours, that starts to bottom out, and then they start to get stronger again, and they get stronger than they were before, and that's super compensation in action. Then of course they start to get weaker again unless you train again, and then when you train they get very weak and then get stronger again, and it goes up and up and up like that, and that's how you progressively get stronger when you're doing weight training, or you progressively get fitter when you're running, or whatever aspect of fitness that we're talking about. But if you overtrain, that say you train your biceps every day, for example, there's no time for them to improve. They're just getting worse and worse and worse. So instead of you getting better, because of this supercompensation effect, it can never kick in. They're just getting worse and worse and worse all the time. So you won't overtrain if you do bicep curls every day, but if you did heavy training every single day and then you went to did your target practice at the Nets, and then you in the evening you went and played a representative cricket match, and then you played on Saturday for your club, and then you played on Sunday for your club, and then you play on Monday, and you go to the gym on Monday morning, and then Monday afternoon you're playing a representative level game. It doesn't take long before the body goes, I've had enough of this.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Well, it's easy. Stop training. Simple as that. Stop training. Give your body time to recover.
Yeah.
There's no harm in taking a week off. There's no harm in taking 2 weeks off. Mm. You're not gonna. The problem is with people who overtrain is that there's a psychological thing as well with a lot of them, in that they think they have to keep training all the time, otherwise they're going to lose the gains that they've got. Well,
yeah.
That is technically that's true, but it's in the short term it's not going to matter. Over a period of 52 weeks of a year, if you take 2 weeks off, that's still a very tiny percentage of the whole year. Even if you count it over a year, and if you're talking about training, training is a very long term thing. You're looking at over 4 or 5 years. You're not looking at over just 1 year. But always make sure that you take at least 1 day's complete rest. That's really important per week. Make sure that there's a day where you're just doing nothing.
Yeah.
Eat well, get plenty of sleep, watch your favorite TV programs, and don't even consider doing anything more strenuous than maybe popping down the shops for another six pack.
Sound advice, David. Well, our next question is from Joe David, and he's 21 years old, and he asks, I used to be a very good football goalkeeper, and I've taken up cricket for the last 18 months. I'm not a bad keeper, but I'm not brilliant. Are there any hints or tips which can be emailed to me? Are there any tips on how far to stand back or where I have to stand, directly to the stumps or off to the right? I have trouble getting catches or stopping shots which are glanced very finely down leg side. And is 21 too old to learn wicketkeeping? Well, David, one immediate recollection of a keeper, a football keeper who's turned to a wicketkeeper is the Indian keeper, Dhoni. Mm. He used to be a football keeper at school, but he did transfer from a football keeper to a cricket wicketkeeper at a very young age, David. So firstly, is there ever an age too old to learn wicketkeeping?
Yeah, it's never too late. The only downside is you're not going to play for your country.
Yeah.
So, you know, at 21, if you take it up, then, you know, you're never going to replace whoever is the incumbent wicketkeeper in your national side. Unfortunately, that's just the case. But you can still play a decent level of cricket and you can still enjoy it. There's no reason why you can't. You know, 21 is young enough to be playing club cricket for a number of years.
Yeah.
So, absolutely, why not? If you've got a passion for it, you enjoy doing it, then that's all you really need. The rest will follow naturally. Mm. So let's talk a little bit about the basics of wicketkeeping. The basics of wicketkeeping are just three things. Your head, your hands, and your feet. And if you're getting them in the right position, more often than not, you're going to catch the ball. So he was specifically asking about standing back and where to stand, you know, when you're standing back. To me, the key to standing back is where you're catching the ball, where the ball is getting to you as a wicketkeeper when the bowler's on. And different wicketkeepers have different areas that they prefer to catch the ball. Some prefer it to catch it sort of around about knee height or a little bit lower, so they stand a little bit further back. And some prefer to catch it more at hip height, so they're a bit more upright when the ball comes through. I'm one of those who prefer to catch it round about sort of hip height. So the fingers pointing down.
Yeah.
It's just a comfortable position to catch the ball because you're standing in what is very similar to that goalkeeper ready position. So you can just catch the ball out in front of you. And if you can catch the ball out in front of you with your knees slightly bent, but your back straight and your core nicely braced, then that's comfortable. And if you're catching a lot of balls, you know, even if you're fielding, you know, for 50 overs, you know, that's still quite a long time of crouching down and coming up. You want to be catching it at a nice height. And if you're catching it, for me anyway, if you're catching it down by your ankles all the time, then that's not as comfortable because you're having to, you know, that's more bending to be done. Now, one side thing I'd say about that is, depending on the level that you're playing, sometimes you'll get a medium pacer and it's a slowish wicket. You're standing so close to be catching the ball at knee height or higher, then there's almost no point in standing back.
Yeah.
Now, once you get, my sort of rule of thumb is once you get within about 7 or 8 yards of the stumps, there's probably no point in standing back anymore because you've got very little time to react to the edges. So, you know, you might as well stand up and go for the stumping because if the bowling's that slow, the batsman may well be coming out of their crease anyway. So my theory is I enjoy standing up to medium paces. So my theory is if you get that close, if you get within 7 yards, just stand up. Unless the bowler really doesn't like it.
Yeah.
I know, Kev, you're one of those who doesn't like the keeper standing up to you, aren't you? So unless the bowler's really anti it, then I'll stand up. But I can't imagine, Kev, someone of your pace, anyone gets within 7 yards of the stumps with you bowling, do they? About 25 yards back.
Sometimes, depends on the keeper. Yeah, I'd like him to stand that back, but depends on the keeper. If there's a really good keeper, he'd want to come up, but if they're not that great, then they usually just stand back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it does depend how good you are standing up to the stumps, but my theory is you're only going to get better by doing it, so just get stuck in, get on with it. You know, you're a wicketkeeper, be a wicketkeeper. Maybe it's a bit different if you've got a stand-in wicketkeeper, but you know, generally, if someone is, you know, they feel their main skill is wicketkeeping, then they should be looking to stand up as quickly as possible. The other part of that question standing back is where do you stand? Again, that depends. That you need to stand as tight to the stumps as you possibly can, but you want to be able to see the point of delivery. Yeah. And ideally, you want to be able to see the ball pitching as well. That's not, you can't always do that, because if it's balls down the leg side, the batsman might get in the way. But you have to be able to see the point of delivery. So if it's a right-arm bowler, right-hand batsman, I start with my left foot about level with off stump, standing back. And then I may move a bit tighter in, depending on who the bowler. If the bowler bowls quite wide on the crease, you can afford to move a little bit tighter in, because you want to be able to move as little as possible if they do fire one down the leg side. If it's a left-hander or a left-arm over bowler bowling to a right-hander, then you're going to have to go a little bit wider, because of the angle just makes it so you can't see. If you have your foot on off stump, then you probably can't see the point of release, because the batsman's body is going to be in the way. If you imagine a right-handed batsman and it's a left-arm over bowler, if you have your left foot level with the off stump, you probably can't see the left-arm over bowler releasing the ball, so you probably have to go a little bit wider just to be able to see the ball. That's fine anyway, because if it's a left-arm over bowler, then they're angling it across the batsman anyway. It's probably going to be coming through to you that little bit wider anyway. Yeah. With the ball going down the leg side, the key is to move as quickly and efficiently as possible. As soon as you see the ball going down the leg side, it's when you're standing back. What you don't want to be doing is staying on the offside and then diving across, which maybe that's a very common thing. You know, you don't move your feet, or you move your feet not enough, and then you have to dive to get to the ball. So, you know, as quickly as possible, as soon as you see the ball going down the leg side, shuffle across. The ball will go behind the batsman, but as long as you're there waiting on the other side for it to come out and you're not ridiculously close like we were talking about before, then you should be able to get hold of it. Also, if your weight's going that way anyway because you're shuffling across, if they do get a fine edge on it, then your hand should be able to go with it and you should be able to catch it. And if they really get a thicker edge on it and you have to put a dive in, then you can put a dive in.
Yeah.
A couple of psychological things as well. You need to have really good concentration as a wicketkeeper. You need to be able to switch off between balls. We talk about that all the time, switching off between the balls. Well, you know, it's like a batsman. You have to be able to switch off between the balls and then not be thinking about anything else when the bowler's just about to deliver the ball. That's a mistake I've been making this season. I've been thinking about field settings and bowling changes.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you're going to make mistakes, especially if you're a rookie keeper. Everyone makes mistakes. Even test wicket keepers make mistakes. Don't worry about it if you make a mistake. Just put it out of your mind. Clear your mind completely of that mistake and focus on the next ball and make sure that you are concentrating as hard as you can on the next ball. And just those two mental things will make a massive, even if you're technically not that great, just those two mental things will make a massive difference.
All right, David, our next question from James, who's in a bit of strife this season. And he says, I've joined a new club and have been put in the second team on both days. I'm struggling to stand out despite being a good cricketer in a relatively average side. I find myself playing against average opposition on both Saturday and Sunday. The pitches in the Saturday league are not great, and I've been given the chance to bat in the top five, but find myself getting 20-odd not out most weeks chasing modest totals. And we've been bowling first a lot this year on Sundays. I've been batting 7 or 8 on Sundays, and the tracks have been road-like, but I've only actually got in once, and I've gotten 15 not out, finishing off our innings in the last over. So I'm struggling for opportunities in second team cricket, which is very disheartening for someone who believes in their own ability at first team level, as I do. I can't really kick off and make a scene about this because it's a new club and I don't want to lose friends straight away. So how can I make my case for a first team place without opportunities? There are players in the first team who are there for the ride, who I would say I'm better than. I just need to prove it, but batting 8 on good tracks and getting the odd chance on the Saturday minefields isn't filling me with confidence. Now, David, I think the first step to going to the first team is confidence, and confidence in yourself. And I think James has that, and he's proved that as well. But how can he, David, as he said, he doesn't get as many opportunities. How can he prove himself to take himself to the first team level? I mean, does he just use what he's given? I mean, he doesn't really get much of a chance. When he does, it's on atrocious pitches. Does he just make the most of circumstances and try the best he could to push himself for that first team place?
It is a difficult one, because when you come to a new team, you've got no track record. If you've got no reputation, you've got to build one up. So there'll be players who maybe you feel you are better than, but they're playing in a higher level than you because in the past they've been reliable. They've scored runs regularly or taken wickets regularly, and they maybe they're having a bad run of form at the moment and they're not doing it at the moment. But if you look back, you can see that they have done it in the past. So, you know, it's going to be hard for selectors to drop those type of players. Mm. So what do you do? So I would say that there are three things that you can do to give yourself a better opportunity and build up that reputation. And the first one is, which I never, ever see anyone, no one's ever come up to me and said this when I know they want to do it. No one's ever said it as a second team captain. No one's ever said this to me. Go up to the captain and go, I want to play in the first team.
Yeah.
No offense to the second team. You're a great bunch of lads. I love playing second team cricket every Saturday. But I want to play a higher standard. I want to push myself. Mm. Can you give me a chance in the second team so I can prove myself to play in the first team? Now, if someone came up to me and said that to me as a batsman, the next week I would definitely be having them in at number three or opening the batting. Because I think that my job as a second team captain is to produce players who can play in the first team. That's my job. I mean, yeah, you want to win games, and if you're producing players who can play in the first team, you're going to win games.
Yeah.
So my first job is to make sure that the first team players who aren't in the first team at the moment, or the potential first team players, are getting as much of a game as possible. Mm. So they open the batting, they bat a three, they open the bowling if they're bowlers, or, you know, if they're a spinner, they'll get a full 15 overs off me. Because that's, you know, they're the ones with the ambition to move on. The guys who are happy playing second team cricket, they don't really mind, you know, they just enjoy playing at a reasonable standard, but it's not too challenging. You know, those are reliable guys, and you want guys like that in the team, but they're all, you know, there's no point in sending somebody like that in to open the batting when you've got somebody who really wants to play in the first team coming in at number six. That's just, there's no point in that. So say it. Go up to the captain and say it. No one's going to be offended. Then, if you say that to the second team captain, then the second team captain turns up to selection with the first team captain, and he says, "Cool, you know that guy who's just joined this season? Yeah. Well, he's really keen to get into the firsts. I'm going to be giving him a fair chance over the week, and we'll keep an eye on him. If you start getting runs, then they can't keep you out of the team. So confess your desires. That's the first thing. I'd also say, if you're not the hardest trainer in your club, then you're not backing what you're saying. You're just saying it because you fancy it, but you're not backing up what you're saying. Your actions have to match your words. So you have to train harder than anybody else. You have to be the first one at net, and you have to be the last one to leave. You have to be the one phoning up your mates after work and going, "Do you want to come down for a net?" You have to be the one turning up on a Saturday morning 2 hours early because you want to have a go on the bowling machine for 20 minutes. You've got to be the guy going to the gym and training properly. And you've got to be the guy working on your fielding until your hands hurt. Because we all have time constraints. You know, no one can train as much as they probably should do if you're playing recreational cricket. You know, you've got a job, you've got a family, you've got other interests. But if you're serious about getting in the first team and you're playing any decent standard of cricket at all, then you've got to be the hardest trainer in your club. Because not only will that make you a better player, more likely to get into the first team, but it will show the first team captain, the second team captain, the chairman of selectors, it'll show them that you're not just saying, "I want to be in the first team." You're backing your words. You're reflecting your ambitions by your actions. Mm-hmm. And that is really what it's about. It's no good just saying it. You have to do it as well.
Yeah.
So practice. And then when you finish, do some more practice.
Yeah.
And then there's one last thing, and that is to do with the way that question was written. There was a few excuses in there, I thought.
Yeah.
Things like, every track I've played on is a minefield. Mm. How can I do how can I do well if every track I play on is a minefield? Every time I play on a Sunday, I'm batting down the order. There's players who are just along for the ride. Saying things like that, is whether they're true or not, it's stuff that is not in your control. And you know what they say, you know, the cliche, control the controllables. You can't do anything about that stuff. Yeah, maybe every week it is a minefield. Maybe every week you are batting down the order if the captain decides to bat you down the order. But, you know, if that happens, you just have to make the best of it and go with it. You know, like I said, if you're batting at 7 or 8 on a Sunday and you're a batsman, then, you know, go to the Sunday captain. Say, you know, can I have a bat, please? I'm not getting much of a chance on a Saturday. Can I have a bat, please? What's he going to say? He might say no, but at least you're asking.
Yeah.
Do the things that you've got control over. You know, a good batsman will still get runs on a bad wicket. Even if it's an awful wicket, if you are 20 not out in a score of, you know, 75 all out.
Yeah.
Well batted. You know, that'd be a real minefield, wouldn't it? If you got bowled out for less than 100, that'd be a real minefield.
Yeah.
If you score 40 of those 100, then someone's going to notice.
Yeah.
So don't worry about the stuff that you can't control. Put that stuff out of your head, because that kind of stuff is an excuse, and excuses yep. don't get you anywhere. Focus on doing what you need to do to get more runs, because the only thing that will get you into the first team is scoring lots of runs.
Yeah.
So do those things. Get 40 not out on a minefield because you've been practicing against the bowling machine, you know, twice a week for half an hour.
Yeah.
It's action that opens the door.
Well, David, we have a usual pitch vision competition. There's a couple of really good questions, David, but I'm sure all our listeners are waiting with bated breath if the keeping question's going to get it this week. So who's going to take it out, David?
Can't really. After saying in previous weeks that I'm biased towards the wicketkeepers, I better give it to somebody else. It was a good wicketkeeping question, and I am tempted to give it to the wicketkeeper, but I don't want to be accused of favouritism. So I'm going to give it to James, because it was a good question, very detailed question, very interesting, and I think it's a problem that a lot of players face.
Yeah.
Either coming to a new club or having to overcome a reputation for playing in a certain way and then not giving the opportunity that they think they deserve. James is the winner.
Perfect. Well, I'm sure that'll help James take him to that first team aspiration he's hoping for. And all you have to do to enter this competition and win a Pitch Vision Academy course like James just has is send in your question to micricketcoach@pitchvision.com. And in the subject title of the email, please enter podcast competition. And if you want other information, tips, advice and tricks, you can find them on our website at www.pitchvision.com. The site is updated daily and includes forums to chat with other cricketers around the world. And you can also subscribe to the Pitch Vision Academy show for free on iTunes. Or you can click the link on the show's page that will take you directly to iTunes to subscribe. Stay tuned for our next show on the 25th of June. So if you want to get in touch with us or have any other questions, you can email us at micricketcoach@pitchvision.com. Thanks for your time, and we hope to see you next time. So this is Kevin Sampath from Sydney, Australia, signing off.
And this is David Hinchcliffe in the UK.